We've had so far 5 graduates. So far, we have no congregation able to call them, but very, very happily, the Lord is blessing certain groups, and we expect that in September or October, there will be several calls go out from Japanese congregations. The thing that's keeping us back, of course, is the whole problem of indigenization as it reaches out into various phases. You know, the problem of buildings and lands, the problem of subsidizing the congregation so that they can call pastors, that's all a great problem in all of these young mission fields. I think they feel it in the Philippines. I'm sure that they're going to have their ups and downs in Korea. And I know that we have great problems in that area in Japan. Whether to subsidize or not. How much to subsidize. What kind of a program of gradually lessening the subsidy we should set up. Who should set it up and who should administer it? These are all problems that we haven't been able to solve in Japan, and I don't think it's because we are not wrestling with the problems. I think it is because it's a very difficult thing to solve these problems. A great deal of our discussion these days centers in these very areas. How it's going to all come out in the end, nobody but the Lord's Spirit knows. But we know that because we are, by His grace, being led by the Spirit, we feel that all the time in our conferences and all of our discussions. Therefore, we don't have any fear of the future, because we know that somehow, even in spite of our bumbling and our lack of experience and our ineptness, the thing is going to come about in God's good time. And so we feel that one of the greatest necessities for missionaries, especially in a young field as Japan is just a good deal of consecrated patience. We also have other schools in Japan. Reverend Carroll would have given you much more of a picture of that. We have a high school and middle school in Hano, and we have a primary school in Urawa, and the Urawa school is growing so that we are hoping to expand also into a middle school. That's one of the things I'm afraid the board is also wrestling with us at the present time. One of the big problems in Japan is that the standard of living is quite high there, and the standard of inflation is even higher. Japan mission costs a tremendous amount of money. It's something we feel very keenly. It's something that we can't actually apologize for, because it isn't our fault. It's something that we have to face. If we want to do these various types of missionary work there, we have to face the fact that it is going to cost us money. That is one of the great responsibilities of the missionary conference in Japan, to weigh these various forms of evangelization and to decide whether they are too costly or whether the cost can never be too great for the souls we can reach through these various means. You know, a 10-year-old isn't supposed to have any children yet, and yet we're an unusual 10-year-old, I guess. We already have a child. We've already fostered a growing little child down there in Okinawa. One of our missionaries is a commuter to Okinawa. That isn't the best way to do missionary work, and yet it seems to be the only way we can do it right now. Pastor Gluck flies down there every month for a week or 10 days and is starting the work in Okinawa. This came mainly through the pressure of our chaplains and our consecrated laymen in Okinawa. And we have adopted a resolution asking the Board for Foreign Missions to make Okinawa a separate field, to bring it up to a status where they can actually call a new man for Okinawa, also perhaps call some of our Japanese pastors for work there, since the Japanese language is used there. I guess I've used up more than my 12 minutes. I'd just like to close by saying I feel one of our greatest problems in Japan is us missionaries. We hope that the Lord will help us to grow, to learn, and to love, because I feel that the only way that any mission is going to succeed is if each and every missionary, his wife and his children, are living on a program of 100% love for the people. And they've got to know that and feel that in everything that you do and say and your total attitude. And that's one of the things that we missionaries are learning too, how to love on a total capacity.
I have Ernie Hahn's report here. Too bad he isn't here because, no, this doesn't sound too much like Ernie Hahn. It'd be much more interesting if he were here himself to present it, I'm sure. Anyhow, I'll read a report as he has written it. Our church in India and Muslim missions. After Indonesia and Pakistan, India claims the largest Muslim population in the world, about 40 million. From Hyderabad, that's about the central part of India, south to Cape Comorin, there are probably some 5 million, probably more than in Arabia. Constitutionally speaking, there is a genuine freedom for all Christians to proclaim the gospel to the Muslims. Normally, at any rate in the south, wherever there are concentration of Muslims, the church is also found. And in the limited area where our newly formed IELC exists, there are also usually Muslims. This is potentially a tremendous advantage for Muslim work, not only from the aspect of the proclamation, for in the history of Muslim work, it can be generally stated that it is not so much martyrdom which the Muslim fears after his conversion, but ostracism from Muslim society which inevitably occurs. The church should fill in the vacuum created as no other fellowship can. Under the present constitution of the IELC, a Muslim board comparable to other boards has been formed. The recognition of the church's obligation to the Muslim is thus implied. Within the Umber Synod, one of the three synods composing the church, a Muslim work committee has also been formed. It is comparable to other committees within this synod. Our church in India already has made some notable contributions to Muslim work. In the Malayalam area, it has contributed 2 pastors and several workers. In the Umber area, 2 pastors and 3 workers. For the new work just begun in the Nairocol area, 1 pastor. Some of these pastors and workers are of the best in our church. All to a greater or lesser degree have been or are being equipped to confront the Muslim more effectively. The seminary. For the past few years, some of the students have shown a real interest in the work. 2 of the best students in this year's graduating class are now among the pastors cited above. The seminary curriculum includes a course in Islam. We have also had opportunities to give some lectures to the students. A good part of the fieldwork program also includes Muslim areas in and around Nagercoil where the seminary is located. Several students have also served their summer vicarage in working among Muslims with us. We have also arranged for a study program with them during the vicarage. If the seminary is a measure of the future looks bright for this aspect of the church's work. Teacher training schools. Some of the workers have come from these. They are among our best teachers. Classes in Islam and Christian approaches to the Muslim have also been given in the past years to the students in the TTS in Ambur. It has also been proposed that we work more closely with some teachers engaged in our schools. College students are also taking greater interest. Hospitals. In the Malayalam area, the hospital staff works effectively in proclaiming the gospel. Actually, it's not a hospital, it's a dispensary at the present time. Probably will be converted into a hospital in the next 5 years or so. Individuals in the Umbur Hospital have also been approached in this matter. It is hoped that at least some of them will evince a greater interest. Congregations. Thus far, the congregations have not recognized their obligations to the Muslim or have bypassed them by one means or another. As far as possible, converts are and will be integrated into local congregations. Seminars and a series of lectures have been given to several congregations. One congregation where there is no missionary around has proved an exception to the rule in that it has had regular programs among Muslims. some concrete proposals given to congregations via congregation or the level of the district synod workers' meetings. One, getting familiar with present work among the Muslims. Two, participation in proclamation through the gospel and correspondence course sales, tract sales, audiovisual aid programs, personal contact. Three, participation on society level. Each one reach one, prayer, discussion, work on the level of point two. Four, congregational participation. Muslim prayer Sunday for church or churches in the district, a good service and litany available. Five, selections of one or two individuals from congregations to specialize and lead. In order to give some of the pastors and laity a better opportunity to understand the challenge, we conducted a Muslim institute for 11 days last September in Vaniambadi. Of the more than 50 that attended, half were from our church. As a result of this and the formation of a Muslim Friends Society recently formed, we have begun publication of a small bi-monthly paper which includes materials on devotional, informational levels, permanent prayer chain, letters from readers on progress of the work, and so forth. In general, humanly speaking, the work among Muslims can be expected to be as effective as the church itself. Though we as missionaries can and do have the opportunity for direct personal work, which is most valuable, we are very conscious of the above-mentioned fact and are devoting much of our effort in an attempt to make the church aware of this labor of love. Signed, Ernest Hahn.
We now have one half hour left, and this will give us a chance to discuss some of the problems that all of us have. It will also give us a chance to learn from each other by means of questions, and we've asked Professor Danker to lead this discussion.
Thank you. I tried to persuade your chairman that he could do a better job of this than I, but he insists that it be done this way, so I obediently follow the chairman's instructions. So, it's all yours now. We've restricted these folks rather sharply to 12 minutes. Here's your chance to get more information from them. What are some of the questions that you'd like to put to some of the speakers who favored us with these good reports? Would you like to add anything to the report which you've read just now by Missionary Hahn, Brother Stelter? You have been, although not working directly in Muslim work, very close to the situation. And what would you add by way of your own eyewitness impressions, corroborations of his report, or would you in any way feel that you do not agree with him? We need some creative tensions here, too.
Miller and Hodgson, because they are in our area, they're in our general area, but they are about 300 miles north of where I am, and of course we had quite a lot of contact with them. He pointed out, and I think that is a significant thing, is that we, on our side, have been supplying the Indian workers for the Muslim work, and on the other side, the other two tenants, Amur and Negrepal, have been supplying the Indian workers for the work among the Muslims. As everybody knows, the work among the Muslims is very difficult. The problem, I think, of Malabar, where the Malayalam work is situated, is that a lot of the Muslims there were not originally Muslim, but were Hindus who were forcibly converted to Mohammedanism by Hyder Ali and Tipu Sultan of Mysore State. And so their brand of Mohammedanism is a little bit different from what we probably usually find among the Mohammedans. In other words, they carried over a lot of their Hinduism and also animism into the Muslim religion. But they seem to be just as fanatic as a regular Muslim from Arabia and other places. So the work among them, there is no question about it, is very difficult. And just when actual tangible results will be seen is a question that nobody can answer. What they are trying in the Muslim work, and I think that probably is the correct approach, is that instead of just getting an individual here and there who will be ostracized and lose his effectiveness, they're trying to hold off some of these that are willing to come forward until they can get a group so that they have a community from which they can spread out.
This is the approach that Kenneth Craig recommends in his justly famous book now, The Call of the Minaret.
Yes, well, I think that probably is, the other way is hasn't proved too effective, but there always the question to my mind is, and I think that would bother me an awful lot in that work, is have we a right to withhold baptism from a man when he's ready for it, even though there are no others that are ready?
Very good. Let's get a response from New Guinea, because they have precisely the same problem there. Do you baptize one or two people out of this pagan primitive society as they did down on the coast years ago, or do you hold off until 9 years later and then baptize a whole group? Let's hear from New Guinea on that.
Well, first of all, I wasn't going to speak to that particular point at first.
Could you?
well, I can try. One of the reasons we didn't baptize individuals at first was because the individuals themselves did not want to be baptized by themselves. They recognized the problem that they would have. And even at my own station before I left, there were perhaps four or five, six men that I would have very gladly baptized, but they themselves said no, they would rather wait because they said it will be too tremendous a pressure on us, and especially they tend to, they're very closely tied together with all of their own people and so forth, and they said, we're afraid that if we were alone, that we might not make it. And so we would rather wait. And so that's their decision that they have made, and I think we can't force them into it. It doesn't seem to hurt them. Rather, it does, I think, help them. And that's the situation that we had. Also, the other thing is, most of the time, in both instances where we have delayed, now the first baptism was delayed at Aurelia, some of the people were ready, but they wanted to delay it for two reasons. They felt they were too small a group to be the first ones, and then the second thing was the missionary who had instructed them all the time wasn't going to be there in there right after their baptism. And they also felt shaky that way. They felt they wanted their father there when they took their first steps. And I think we have to take that into consideration with these people, especially since everything they have learned from one man, and they look to him for advice and so forth in these early things. If they were a people who had the entire scripture and you could just say, well, there's everything you have, and all of them could read and so forth, it'd probably be a little different. But their own desires are the things that determined it for us, rather than what we ourselves want.
An illustration from Japan occurs to me at this point. Missionary Kreiling will remember Mukaida-san, our first Sunday school teacher in Meguro, very fine Christian girl who early came under the influence of the gospel in the history of our mission. This girl was a trained teacher. She was able to keep 150 children of all ages enthralled as she told them the Bible stories. And we thought surely that Mukaida-san would be among the very first to be baptized. But Mukaida-san became married, and she was not among the first. She
wasn't among the second or third group either. Makaida-san determined to wait until her husband would be baptized with her. And this is what she did. That day finally came, and they were baptized together. She was afraid that if she were baptized immediately, her then non-Christian husband would make it impossible for her to practice her religion, to go to church, to have her children baptized, and the end result would be that neither he nor she would be Christians. Now, this places us into certain theological difficulties, perhaps. This, I think, is a very interesting point to discuss.
Well, my point is this, as I think I would agree there, when they don't ask for it, but what if they ask for it? What are we going to do then? Mm-hmm. Say, well, we've got this rule, we're going to wait.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think then you would discuss it with the person and show him both sides of the question, and ultimately, I think we would allow him his choice to stand. But certainly show him both sides of the question, show him the difficulties that might arise, and then ask him to put it to decision. And also, I think we do have sometimes a scriptural principle to do things that are expedient at a certain time, and show him the expediency of perhaps waiting to make his confession more valuable for the kingdom or something like that. I think that that would be the approach. However, I think we should always finally let the choice remain with that individual.
Dean Schiffer.
I wonder, Mr. Stelter, you mentioned the fanaticism of the Muslims. This must have something to do, or must have some relationship to the community aspect we hear so much about among the Muslims. I wonder if you could describe this and describe it in contrast to the congregational life of Christianity.
Well, they don't hesitate to do anything to somebody that is converted. They'll just murder him or something, poison him or something like that, and get him out of the way completely. Of course, not that that doesn't happen among the Hindus also occasionally. I know I had one case quite a number of years ago where a young Nair boy, a high caste boy, was coming for instruction, and all of a sudden he didn't show up. And about a month went by, and he came again to see me, and I asked him what was the matter, and he says, well, he says, I've been sick. He says, my brother almost killed me because I was coming to see you. But he says, I'm going to come anyhow. Well, he came for a short time, and a little bit later on, I heard that his own relatives had poisoned him and killed him just to keep him from coming. So that happens among the Hindus, too, but it's much more vicious among the Muslims. And the Muslims, I think, in general, are also very much mistrusted by the Hindus because they are a pretty rough lot. And if they're ousted thrown out of their own community, they probably would have a very difficult time of making a go of things.
Commissioner Stelter, I wonder whether the thrust of Dean's question wasn't just a bit different, contrasting the inner life of the Muslim community with the inner life of the Christian community, contrasting them as fellowships. Is this perhaps the thrust of your question, if I caught it correctly? In other words, is the Christian community, in taking these people in, providing them with as firm and satisfying a fellowship as the Muslim community previously did?
No, I mean, because, like I said before, there is a definite amount of distrust among the Hindus, and of course that also carries over into the Christian congregation that comes from the Hindus. Let's put it very bluntly, the Mohammedan has a terrible reputation morally, and that is one thing they are very much afraid of, that the Hindus or the Indian Christians that come from the Hindu community, that they are well and their thinking also is still very much, in too many cases at least, along caste lines, and he just isn't that caste, that's all. That's another problem that has to be overcome. It is unfortunate that taking it as a whole, there, of course there are congregations that are exceptions to that, but taking it as a whole, a Christian congregation coming from Hindus, from among the Hindus, is very reluctant and hesitant in accepting a Mohammedan into their midst, a Mohammedan convert.
Thank you very much. Dean?
With this question, Commissioner Sproul, you spoke of the initialization of the congregation and the use of these evangelists in carrying out the gospel. Now, do these handle the Lord's Supper?
No, yes, they don't. I mean, see, in most cases, these evangelists are going and preaching to heathen. Now, within the early Christian congregations, see, the first congregations were only formed, it's not even a year. It's about a year ago now. And the very first one, more than 50% of these men were workers. I mean, they were evangelistic workers. And as such, the congregation did not form in just one place, but rather these men were sent out to all various outlying areas in the circuit that they belonged to, the Aurelia Circuit. And they did preaching and instruction.
I mean, they lived at the place, and they'd come in once a week back to the main station for
further strengthening. And this, of course, this type of thing began well before they were baptized. My circuit, I have men that are now living on stations. They're not baptized yet. They come in only once a week for instruction. But they're reaching heathen. Now in the Yarramunda circuit, that's where one of the larger congregations is now, there they have organized to this extent that they have appointed five of the better evangelists and men who can read and have from witness of their faith and their actions, they have appointed them as their pastors, if you will. And these men are in training now. In other words, I believe that they assisted with the baptisms, the subsequent baptisms, and they assisted in the examinations for baptism. That's where they're going first. That's their first step. That they are going to, from now on, determine who in the community who has been instructed and request baptism should be baptized or shouldn't, whether they're ready for it or not, whether their knowledge is sufficient, and so forth. They will determine that. They will examine the people. And they will eventually, we hope, be able to take care of confession and absolution. But they have to have a certain amount of training in that. And while we're not having a seminary as such, these men are receiving their training as they go along, practically. And once or twice a year, we have a period when all of these men who are doing this leadership work in every one of our circuits, they come together for 2 or 3 weeks and receive this. Certain things, one example, the Christian burial, that was automatically theirs. I mean, instead of every time someone dies among the Christians or one who was instruction, that the missionary goes out to some little place and takes care of giving the word of God and encouragement at that funeral, that the church takes care of now. And then the next step is determining what infants should be baptized and which one shouldn't. Now, that's a problem. Do you baptize the infants of heathen and so forth? That we could probably talk for hours on. We do over there. And then eventually we want them to take over the whole thing. We have seen the mistake that other missions in New Guinea have made, where they have native pastors, and yet the native pastors don't give the sacrament. They wait sometimes for a missionary. And some places where they've had mission work for 25 years, they have no native pastors as yet. They have teachers who instruct the people, get them all ready for baptism and so forth. And when it finally comes time for baptism, the missionary comes in and baptizes them. And for that reason, sometimes these people only have communion once a year, because that's the only, the missionary only comes around once a year to these little outlying communities. And we feel that's terrible. And we're trying to encourage our people to come to communion every month at least. And, well, as our work grows, we won't be able to do that unless we have these people take care of themselves. And in order to show them that it isn't only a man from the outside, a white man or an Australian, an American who can administer the sacraments, we have already used other native Christians who weren't Engas, but who were communing with us. And, for example, myself, I have a couple of helpers who are missionaries sent in by congregations from CSE Islands off the coast of New Guinea. And when we take communion, one of them administers the sacrament to me. And that way already, the people see that, well, this isn't only something that he can do. And at the baptisms, we've also had these men assist.
You're a determined missionary, Booth. In other words, that you're not going to put your people on a starvation diet.
Oh, no. I mean, that's the thing. I mean, we want to get it to the point, and we constantly tell them this, that we're planting the tree, but they're going to have to see that it grows. And we never know if something happens and we can't stay there. We don't want the thing to collapse because we're not there. And say, some places in New Guinea, I don't think during the war they had the sacrament until the missionaries came back. Well, that's terrible. And we don't want that to take place among our people, if at all possible.
You're seeking to follow the example of Paul, who when he left a place, left a church completely equipped with everything it needed to function as the body of Christ, including the sacrament. Of course, at the same time, you're also continuing to give them the fullest and the most careful guidance, I would assume.
We try.
Art Erb, I think you had your hand up.
I was wondering, hearing about the evangelists and the blood and training, what sort of support do they have in the current economic
support? I would say the very important thing about New Guinea is that no man has to work at a specific job 8 or 10 hours a day in order to get his bread, but he rather has his own garden plot.
They're landowners. Everybody owns his own piece of land. And while there are some men who are a little more wealthy than others, and some men whom they call paupers, there is no one who's starving. We don't have that problem like they have in the East, where they have the starving masses and people who can hardly scrape enough together to exist on. We have well-fed people. We have people who have a certain amount of leisure time because they only have to plant their gardens and then tend them. And, well, that gives them leisure time. For example, we have instruction classes 5 days a week for at least 2 hours a day with our catechumens. And, well, everybody can come. Well, most places in the world you couldn't do that because the people are so busy in keeping body and soul together. Our people don't have that problem. The same way with this evangelism. Well, so for these evangelists, what we encourage the people to do is supply them with the basic necessities, food, firewood in the house, and garden ground. And if they do that, then those men are on the level of their own people. And eventually, we will expect them to, or we're encouraging them to do that already, to supply them with a little bit more so that the man who has learned to be clean can still be clean, he can still get his soap and his cloth that he wants for himself and his family, for clothing and so forth. But the people will be able to swing that. We're not trying to all of a sudden set up these evangelists and these teachers who will go out among their own people on a much higher level, but rather letting them continue on that level, and that way the people can support them.
Here's a question for the new recruits to get the answers from the veterans. So, keep Brad fishing.
Art. About the freshmen from the Philippines, the idea of the indigenous church and all the different languages. Of course, recognizing the English being, but would this be any sort of a barrier at all for the people feel that the difference of the language groups would be a barrier to the United Indigenous Church and the community.
So the Philippines.
Louis Dorn. He's our expert on the Philippines.
I say the Philippines is united by means of English more than anything else. Just that St. Paul could go around preaching Greek in any place he wanted to. That's about what you can do with the English in most places. There is no distaste for the English language. Not so much between them as with Tagalog and the others, because the Tagalog has been chosen as the basis for the national language, and that sort of cracks some of the others. But it's nothing serious. It's like people from Brooklyn not like arguing about the Yankees, you know.
Any development of English as a Koine in India, Missionary Stelter? What about the competition between English and Hindi in India as the lingua franca?
Well, the South is very definitely against Hindi, while the North is very definitely in favor of it, primarily because the Hindi is spoken by a larger group up North and spoken by very few down South, and very little English is spoken up North, and a lot of English is spoken down South.
Art?
We put this in another area, and that's on the common church. What is this difference, the great difference in life means in the idea of one body, one congregation?
It is really a problem, because many, many times they have to overcome prejudices. And in this one congregation that I mentioned, that is the great problem, is they don't form language cliques which break the congregation into several groups. That is a problem. I'd say that it can be overcome. It is overcome. English in Hong Kong, too, is a language that you can use. There are about 10,000 Europeans in Hong Kong and about 3 million Chinese, which means that most of the Chinese would like to speak English and enjoy coming to classes and hearing English. So it's a useful language also.
Missionary Truth.
Well, just in connection with this, in India now, with this Muslim and the work among the Hindus, is it the plan of the Indian church now to actually absorb this Muslim work, or is that going to be carried out as a separate thing? In other words, are we going to, someday, the Lord's blessing coming upon this Muslim work, have a Muslim synod that will cooperate with the Hindu synod, or are we going to try to bring those in and make actually one church out of these people, since they are one nation now?
Well, actually, the aim is not to start Muslim congregations, but to integrate the Muslims as they come in our other, in our Hindu, in the congregation from the Hindu background. Yes, I mean, there is no aim, and that's why just like we have a board for theological education and a board for other education, we also have a board for Muslim work and board for other work right in the synod. I mean, there is provision for that. The idea is to keep it one unit and not two separate churches or organizations.
Thank you, Missionary Stelter. Dr. Schmidt.
The chairman, it's too bad that Missionary Khan is not here. I think he would wax eloquent talking about the idea of having that whole string of Christian congregations on the east side of India. Krishnagiri, Barwar, Ambur, Burnambak, and so forth, consider themselves a mission field made to order for Mohammedan work. They have Mohammedans right along there, right next door to our Christian congregations. And they try their best to make the Christians understand that they need to absorb the converts from Mohammedanism. So you've got this right in front of your door. It's a mission field made to order. Mohammedan speaks very eloquently about just that point.
Pastor Paul Mail, Chairman of the Mission Board, back to the floor.
Hey, my question pertains to a different subject. The time's running out, and I'm just a little curious about asking this question here.
Move right ahead.
Well, we've heard a great deal about preaching, teaching, weeping, and evangelism, and mission. And
that a lot of our congregations and pastors throughout the length and breadth of the land are quite enthused about them, and some of them are. But I was wondering whether any thought has been given to this type of an approach, or whether any planning is this being done, or whether it would work anywhere on any of the fields, or what. I'm sure that both of you are acquainted with the preaching mission.
Who'd like to reply? Mr. Crowley, in Japan.
I've never seen one of those things in action, so I don't know just exactly what it is. It sounds something like the old revival type of thing. Does it sort of get close to that? You see, one of the things you've got to realize is that we have smaller groups and don't have as much interplay as these preaching businesses take as far as lay participation. However, me, not the prefecture, we're fortunate in that only in a tent. It's a small size service tent. We can pack about 200 adults or about 350 children in for it. And I think that is perhaps one of the closest things on the farm field that comes to this preaching, teaching, reaching. We get our members all excited about this and carry on this campaign and then follow it up. But of course, the reaching part of it also goes through the roots now to follow up. There's where our real evangelistic thrust through the pavement comes in.
What it amounts to briefly is that there's a concentrated effort put forth. And the entire congregation is to be involved in this effort, and services are conducted on five successive evenings. And the members of the congregation are expected to go out and bring friends or prospects and so on to these services to acquaint them with the church. And the sermons, of course, are all supposed to be brief, to the point, very, very much evangelistic and so on.
Louis Dorn from the Philippines.
One of the things I've been hoping for in further is to observe one of these PTRs, partly the thought of adjusting it to the situation of the Philippines, and I'm sure from what I've heard that it can be used over there, partly because there's so much Western culture in the Philippines. But I'm hoping that we can make use of it.
May I observe at this point that President Snyder of the Brazil district observed after visiting this country and witnessing one of the PTRs out west, President Snyder felt this would be readily adaptable to the situation down there in Brazil. And I have the feeling that perhaps more of this could be used than many of us missionaries perhaps feel. May I also observe at this point that this points up the necessity for doing something that we haven't been able to do this year, namely, in a future year, take down this partition between the two sections of this classroom. The Home Mission Institute, which we're running this week too, is discussing this kind of thing on the other side of this folding partition. And there are points at which there could be more creative and helpful interchange between home missions and overseas missions, and maybe in another year we can arrange that. There were a couple of hands here. Martin, Pastor Martin of the Mission Board.
Several of the missionaries, when they reported, were very apologetic about mistakes that have been made on the mission field. I want to assure them that our church here at home is just full of mistakes through and through. A century ago, our men did not know the first thing about an indigenous church, I believe. And a century later, some of them still know nothing about it. A week ago, I asked one of our elders to go and call on a very sick lady in our congregation. I was going to be out of town. All the other pastors in the city were out of town too. I told him about this call, how he should make it, the problem. And when I returned Friday night, this 70-year-old cancer patient with tears in her eyes told me, "That little Mr. Nelius, I never knew he could do a thing like that." He had a wonderful prayer with her, a scripture reading. I went over to his home that very evening and thanked him for going there. And he said, "You know, Pastor, we at Trinity never have ever done anything like that. No elder at Trinity has ever been called upon to perform any spiritual function." Can you imagine that in a century-old congregation in Christian America?
All they did was ring the bell.
that points up the weaknesses, some of the weaknesses in our synod. And then I believe it was Kreiling mentioned the greatest problem in the mission field, as the greatest problem here at home too, is the individual missionary or pastor. He mentioned the problem of disciplining oneself. That's a terrific thing for a pastor properly to discipline himself and to give the proper amount of time to the different, many different facets of his work. We spoke about being a parish pastor or a missionary. You know, any pastor in the city could be so involved in his parish, in pastoral care, that he never would do any missionary work at all. If I would not designate Tuesday and Friday afternoons for nothing else but mission calls, I dare say I never would make any mission calls. You have to discipline yourself, whether you're on the mission field, whether you're in the ministry here at home. So the problems we have are not problems which are particular or peculiar just to the missionary. We at home here have many of the same problems.
And you've been both, you know. I think we have room for just one more. That's me. All right, I think then we come to the end of this period. Dr. Bartling, do you suppose we'd have 5 minutes for a little stretch at this point? Do we have time?
2 minutes. Mark and I can sure stretch
50 minutes. That would be more. All right, 5 minutes. Can we keep it really five, though? Because Dr. Bartling will have some good things to share with us.